The nation's top security experts have said a cyber 9/11 is imminent.
So how afraid should we be of cyber war? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A reporter at a campaign rally last year watched a politician lie and called the office.
So I called Corey and I said, is there a way that we can get the truth into people's hands at the moment that they need it? So a politician can't stand in front of them and just tell them things that aren't true.
And new evidence suggests that Truman Capote took excessive artistic license when writing In Cold Blood.
I wanted to believe that Lance had cleanly won 7/30 France titles. I wanted to believe that Truman Capote had produced the greatest piece of nonfiction ever while hewing to the facts.
There's more after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States. Thank you.
During Tuesday night's State of the Union speech, along with the President's call to lift the middle class, raise the minimum wage, and invest in new technologies, he highlighted a critical security concern.
Earlier today, I signed a new executive order that will strengthen our cyber defenses by increasing information sharing and developing standards to protect our national security, our jobs, and our privacy. But now Congress must act as well by passing legislation to give our government a greater capacity to secure our networks and deter attacks. This is something we should be able to get done on a bipartisan basis.
The President's executive order wants the government to share information about potential cyber threats with public and private owners of critical infrastructure. The day after the State of the Union, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or CISPA, was reintroduced in the House after having died last year in the Senate. CISPA shares the same goal as the executive order, but it also wants private entities to share threat information with the government. That makes privacy advocates a little queasy.
They may be queasy, but this week, the Washington Post reported on a secret document that described Chinese hackers penetrating, quote, a wide range of sectors, including energy, finance, information technology, aerospace, and automotives. Bloomberg News described Chinese hacker attacks as, quote, a continuous invasion. In the midst of the legislative fight over cybersecurity last year, OTM's Alex Goldman decided to look into just how worried we should be about the threat of all-out cyber warfare.
The alarms have been sounding about attacks like these for years, coming from people like Secretary of Defense and former CIA Director Leon Panetta.
There's a strong likelihood that the next Pearl Harbor that we confront could very well be a cyber attack.
Michigan Congressman Mike Rogers.
A cyber attack that could shut down critical infrastructure and potentially cause physical damage to the United States.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
The nation's top security experts have said a cyber 9/11 is imminent.
And the screenwriters for the fourth movie in the Die Hard franchise.
FAA just issued a critical alert. The entire network went down.
Transportation systems crashing and they just hit the entire financial sector.
These kind of attacks are not only hard to protect against, they're hard to identify. In fact, to date, there's only been one verified incident of destroying critical infrastructure via computers. That would be Stuxnet, a complex computer worm believed to be a joint effort of Israel and the United States that was used against an Iranian nuclear facility. Reportedly, Stuxnet fooled facility workers by making it look as though the plant was functioning normally, while it turned centrifuges at the plant on and off until they broke apart. But Stuxnet was not a classic cyber attack.
It's not as if some American soldier was simply at a terminal somewhere and sent commands across the internet thousands of miles to Iran and cause something to blow up.
Jerry Brito, director of the Technology Policy Program at George Mason University's Mercatus Center.
In order for Stuxnet to take place, you had to have an amazing investment in traditional intelligence and espionage. You had to have people infiltrate the Natanz facility in Iran to really understand the system that they had in place at that facility. And once they had the weapon, once they had Stuxnet built, they had to get somebody to put it on the computer system. The problem with folks in Congress being hysterical about cyber war is that they're sort of giving short shrift to the fact that Stuxnet was incredibly difficult. I think the nations that could have the capability that the U.S. would have with Stuxnet are very few.
In fact, evidence of attacks on American infrastructure are so scant, I assume cyber war was just a convenient fiction, exploited by lawmakers to push unpopular, restrictive internet regulation. But the more I learn about the online vulnerability of U.S. infrastructure, the more serious the threat seems to be. So how scared should you be? Well, to target a piece of infrastructure, cyber warriors would look for what are called SCADA systems, which control industrial processes. Everything from milking machines on dairy farms, to banks of elevators, to water treatment plants. One of the simplest ways to safeguard our infrastructure is to simply keep SCADA systems off of the global internet, a technique that's called air gapping. The reason Stuxnet cannot be remotely installed on computers at the Iranian nuclear plant is because the system was air-gapped. But even though air-gapping SCADA systems is ostensibly the industry standard, that doesn't mean it's always happening.
I worked in quality assurance for GE Energy for 5.5 years.
Aaron Leverett is a security researcher with IO Active.
I heard from my superiors that we didn't need to do a lot of security testing because these devices were never connected to the internet. And that's false on two counts. One, that they are connected to some degree. And secondly, that being disconnected, they would be entirely secure. There are still issues even if you're not connected. For example, employees who work for you who mean you harm. So I wanted to combat that.
Leverett found a way to identify over 12,000 SCADA systems connected to the internet, including things like
water treatment facilities, geothermal heat plants, power plants, dams, bridges, train stations, these sorts of things.
So should you be scared that, according to General Keith Alexander, head of the National Security Agency, there's been a, quote, 17-fold increase in computer attacks on American infrastructure between 2009 and 2011? Not that scared. None of those attacks have had any impact. There's a vast difference between accessing a poorly secured piece of infrastructure and causing pipelines to explode. More likely, our enemies would combine some form of cyber attack with traditional warfare. John Arquilla is a professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Postnaval Graduate School.
When I introduced the concept of cyber war 20 years ago in an article called Cyber War is Coming, the thing I envisioned most was the use of cyber attacks by militaries in the field to cripple their opponents' responses, in a way similar to the use of air attacks in the initial blitzkriegs of 1939 and 1940. They'd knock out communications. Cyber attacks in Georgia in 2008 did just that and greatly enhanced the ability of the Russians to move forward with few casualties and quite effectively. This is something that I think is a prototype for what can be done on a larger scale in the future.
So should you be scared that Arquilla wholeheartedly believes that we're already in the midst of an escalating cyber war? Not that scared, because he also believes that it may be preferable to traditional warfare.
Throughout all of history, war was just a matter of hurling mass and energy at your opponents. Now we hurl mass, energy, and information. The actual wars that are fought can be waged with far less casualties. I think the possibility of using cyber attack to cripple the military command and control of two countries getting ready to go at it with each other, were it done under some kind of international control, such as the blue helmets of the UN clicking for the cause, that also is pretty cool to think about. The not-so-cool part is, do we, because of the ease of having cyber warfare, do we intervene more often? As Robert E. Lee once said, it is well that war is so terrible, otherwise we should grow too fond of it. Well, cyber war may not be so terrible, and we may grow over fond of it.
In his book, Confront and Conceal, the New York Times' David Sanger shows that the U.S. might already be applying Arquilla's vision of cyber war.
You know, if you look back at what has been different about the Obama approach to national security, it's been the embrace of something called the light footprint strategy, The idea here is to find a way for the United States to be able to deal with its adversaries without sending 100,000 troops, without occupying a nation for 5 years, without spending several hundred billion or $1 trillion. So light footprint strategies involve usually high-tech weaponry that's a lot less expensive and doesn't put personnel at risk. The difficulty, of course, is that in the case of a cyber campaign, not just states hold the monopoly on the weapons here.
Many interviewed for this story shared Sanger's fear that the democratization of technology enables not just nation states, but common criminals, curious hackers, and activist groups like Anonymous to wage war. John Arquilla warns us to beware the boomerang effect.
The first time around with Stuxnet, there may have been some investment required. There are hackers already who have reverse engineered it. And guess what? The next weapons are a lot easier. There's no question that a new arms race is underway. And the problem, of course, is that every time you use one of these techniques, you have signaled how to develop these weapons. So yeah, the race is on. And unfortunately, it's not going to be limited to a few great powers. Everybody's in this race.
The Armed Forces Cyber Command Unit, now about 900 strong, has announced that it will expand to nearly 5,000 employees. But civilian businesses have yet to settle on a regulatory standard for security that they can live with. The challenge is meeting potential threats without sacrificing individual privacy. In fact, every debate over the internet seems to be about protecting privacy, whether in personal relationships, commerce, or now even in war. For On the Media, I'm Alex Goldman.
And in related news, there's this. The Pentagon this week announced that it's created a new medal for troops who have a direct impact on combat operations, but do it off the battlefield. That means the Distinguished Warfare Medal will be open to drone pilots and those engaged in cyber warfare. One caveat, since the Department of Defense doesn't publicly acknowledge offensive cyber operations, the medals, too, might be secret.
Coming up, the Washington Post misreports that the FCC will mandate free Wi-Fi for all, and they didn't even correct it.
They wrote a follow-up story that was titled, I believe, Five Things to Know About Free Public Wi-Fi. It didn't really clarify much. I believe it ran on page 14, whereas the first story ran above the fold in page 1. And the first story is still up, and it has not been changed at all.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com and 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Pew Charitable Trusts, working with states to improve voting systems and the electoral process. At pewtrust.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On February 3rd, the Washington Post splashed a big above-the-fold page one Sunday story by reporter Cecilia Kang that led with this. The federal government wants to create super Wi-Fi networks across the nation so powerful and broad in reach that consumers could use them to make calls or surf the internet without paying a cell phone bill every month. Free public internet access was a story so tantalizing that many other news outlets instantly ran with it. The article was paraphrased and linked all over the internet, drawing the attention of Ars Technica writer John Brodkin. When he read the piece, he noticed one little problem.
The entire thing is basically false because the FCC isn't creating any wireless networks. What it's actually doing is freeing up a little extra spectrum, which are wireless airwaves, that could be used for wireless internet networks. But someone outside of the government likely would have to build them. And there's, you know, very little reason to think that the networks would be so expansive and broad that everyone would be able to get access or replace their home internet connections or their cell phone bills.
It wouldn't have taken a whole lot to realize that what Kang was describing was really just the latest iteration of policy formation and not nearly as expansive or juicy as Kang described. What would it have taken to find out that she missed the boat?
You have to have an understanding of what's already happening because the story didn't specify what the actual process was. It was talking about a technology called white spaces, and yet it never mentioned the phrase white spaces. I've covered this, so when I read it after a few minutes, I was able to sort of think it out. But a lot of the reporters who saw it and just ran with the story, they didn't have that background to know that it wasn't what it seemed, and they didn't check either. I don't know why they didn't check.
Now, John, in doing your verifying, you ran into this weird rabbit hole where you spoke to the FCC and then you spoke to the ombudsman at the Post and heard completely opposite things.
I emailed the ombudsman at the Post. I got a response that said the FCC confirmed to the Post that their story was correct. But I talked with a couple people at the FCC.
At the highest levels.
At the highest levels, who confirmed that the Post story was wrong, and they were interested in getting the correct story out there. They told me, you know, we never told the Post that their story was correct.
The Post story suggested an internet-free lunch that captured the imagination of a lot of people to the point that once it was thoroughly debunked, it still didn't go away.
It kept spreading.
Tell me about the petition.
There's a petition on a site called watchdog.net. It is titled, Tell FCC Don't Back Down on Nationwide Free Wi-Fi! Exclamation point. The funniest thing about the petition is there's actually a sentence that begins with the words, facts are facts.
Now, some news organizations took the line dangled in the water by the Washington Post and ran with it. Some realized their mistake and did the right thing. You have pointed out Mashable's approach to dealing with the error.
Mashable is a tech website, and their first story is wrong, just like everyone else. But the reporter who wrote it, once he realized, wrote a completely new follow-up story saying the government is not creating this free public Wi-Fi network. And Mashable also apologized for its earlier coverage. A lot of other news organizations didn't do that.
And among those that didn't do that is the Washington Post itself. What did the Post do?
They wrote a follow-up story that was titled, I believe, Five Things to Know About Free Public Wi-Fi. It didn't really clarify much. I believe it ran on page 14, whereas the first story ran above the fold in page 1. And the first story is still up, and it has not been changed at all. The problem with that is a lot of the incorrect articles out there are still linking to that first story. So people reading the article and following the links, they won't get the correction.
Now, you spoke to Cecilia Kang. What did she have to say about this fiasco?
Well, our conversation was private, but I think I can say that she seemed to understand that the story was wrong, or at least that it led to a repetition of a story that was wrong, and she was very interested in setting the record straight. And then she posted the second story, which sort of clarified things but didn't really correct it.
So what was called for in this case?
I think a clear correction at the top of the first story should have been done immediately. Because there actually is a tiny grain of truth in the original story. If everything goes right, some access to Wi-Fi could be expanded. Maybe some of that could be free. There is a story to tell about that process, and that could have been done in a follow-up if they had wanted to spend more time on it.
Yeah, so one last question. Should I cancel my Verizon Fios service?
Only if you want to go off the grid.
All right, John. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
John Brodkin writes for Ars Technica. Neither the writer of the Washington Post article nor any Washington Post editor agreed to be interviewed, but did say, quote, the Washington Post stands by our story. The FCC declined to comment on the record.
So the Washington Post stands by its story. But it might have served the public better if the paper had made someone available to talk to us about it. Last summer, after a particularly bad run of errors and lies in the press, I checked in on the fact-checking process. The story begins with Regret the Error blogger Craig Silverman's take on why it behooves news organizations to answer questions from fellow journalists.
If we make it a practice to stonewall requests for basic information about a transgression that's happened, then when we turn around and we do the exact same thing to government agencies or to large institutions in society or companies they can say, well, you didn't answer questions from fellow journalists when something happened in your house. Why would I tell you about what's going on in our house?
That lesson isn't lost on Ira Glass. When This American Life's famous episode about Mike Daisy's trip to an Apple factory in China, concluding with an indictment of the company, turned out to be largely fabricated, Glass produced another episode anatomizing the errors and the process and agonizing over the breach of the listener's trust.
I mean, my fear was that people were going to ask, well, what about everything else you've ever put on the radio? I feel like we can't let this happen again as a staff. We can go to our audience once and say, like, oh, we messed this one up, but we cannot go to them a second time. So now we're spending between $300 and $1,000 a show on fact checkers. We set aside $60,000 in this year's budget to hire freelance fact checkers, people who work for, you know, national magazines and the New York Times magazine. I want the stories to be right.
Different media outlets handle checking in different ways. On our show, we scrupulously research our guests, prep ourselves, and even fact check during the interviews. We're not live, so we can do that. We still make lots of mistakes, so we have a link to corrections and where listeners can report errors on our homepage. And we notate the transcripts to reflect the original error and the fix. NPR's All Things Considered produces up to 10 interviews a day. That's a lot of vetting, prepping, and post-interview follow-up. And so, says executive producer Chris Turpin, correct they must.
And it's why we took to running letter segments pretty much every day, which we didn't used to do. We are the first draft of history. We shouldn't pretend that we don't get things wrong on a regular basis. We have to work fast. We try very, very hard to get it right. But yeah, of course we should fess up when we don't get stuff right. We shouldn't be mealy-mouthed about it.
I have 16 people in this department, including myself, and at any given point, there are typically 8 or 9 languages that people speak fluently.
Peter Canby oversees fact-checking at The New Yorker.
Mandarin, Arabic, Urdu, Russian, Italian, French, Spanish.
He says New Yorker fact-checkers do reporting in reverse.
In other words, we take pieces apart and put them back together again. We talk to the writer's sources. We also try to get to people who were mentioned in the story who maybe the reporter didn't even speak to. If we have a secondhand characterization of somebody else's activities, then we will try to either get the reporter to go to that person or go to that person ourselves just to get their perspective on things.
But what happens if the primary source disagrees vehemently with the characterization or the quote of the reporters? How do you know who to trust?
Well, that's an excellent question. We get notes and transcripts from reporters before we call people. And then if somebody starts trying to back off something they clearly said, then we would say to them, sorry, we're offering you a chance to fix things that are factually wrong and not to rewrite your interview. Naturally, that tends to be kind of a conversation stopper. So when that happens, we would typically go right away to the writer and to the editor, and then we have to iron it out.
Craig Silverman of the Regret the Error blog believes that in the future, the fact-checking of breaking news will make far greater use of the news consumer. In fact, he says that kind of fact-checking has already arrived, performed by NPR's social media dynamo, Andy Carvin.
He has found a way to transform his Twitter feed into an instant newswire about events in the Middle East. And he does that by choosing the right people to follow, by engaging with people on a constant basis, interviewing people and talking to people. One of the other things that he does, he might retweet somebody reporting that bombs have just fallen in one area, and he'll retweet it, but he'll add proof, or can you add a photo?
Carvin's interactive process offers the kind of crystalline transparency that Silverman craves. And yet, the very culture of fact-checkers is rooted in invisibility. When a Time magazine editor hired its first fact-checkers back in the 20s, they were exclusively young women.
Because while he considered this fact-checking to be important, it wasn't so important that he would hire men to do it.
He sent a memo around about the ethos of fact-checking. He says, any bright girl who really applies herself to the handling of the checking problem can have a very pleasant time with it and fill the week with happy moments and memorable occasions. The most important thing to remember in checking is that the writer is your natural enemy. He is trying to see how much he can get away with. Remember that when people write letters about mistakes, it is you who will be screeched at.
There's a lot in there. I mean, wow, you know? And what I think is certainly true to this day is that typically people only notice fact checkers if some terrible mistake has been made.
Oh, it's a perilous biz.
Do you have proof that your genitals look like the Virgin Mary?
Can you confirm that you own a red Corolla?
Can you confirm that bootcut jeans are so last year?
Perilous, but not manly. That's the central joke of the Funny or Die web series FCU, Fact Checkers Unit. Here, the daring fact-checking duo pray at the altar of Alex Trebek.
Dear Father of Facts, please give us the strength to conduct this research quickly and properly. Amen.
That old Time magazine editor sure was right about the screeching. Media outlets these days are enthusiastically eating their own and each other, just like they did back in the days of the penny press. And maybe that's a good thing, but it's not for the delicate or the dainty. You can't run, and you certainly can't hide. Not anymore. Imagine if instead of the laborious, costly, and problematic fact-checking process currently available to news consumers, you could just hold up your phone at, say, a political rally, and an automated voice would tell you if what you are hearing is true or false. Well, in August of 2011, Washington Post national political editor Steven Ginsburg was extremely frustrated during a rally for Michelle Bachmann in Indianola, Iowa.
There were maybe 30 or 40 people there. It's leading right up to the Iowa straw poll, and Michelle Bachmann is riding high. This was sort of the high moment of her run for the president. You have a small midday rally, people who took a little time off from their work, and here you had an elected member of Congress not being on the level with them. Had they known, they could have said, wait a second, that's not exactly right. Let's talk about what's real and see where we get from there. So I called Corey and I said, is there a way that we can get the truth into people's hands at the moment that they need it? So a politician can't stand in front of them and just tell them things that aren't true.
My first answer to him was, yes, we can do something.
Corey Haik is the Washington Post's executive producer for digital news. What did you guys do?
At that time, Siri for iPhone was sort of hot. And I thought, maybe there's something with that. You know, you're standing in a field in Iowa. You can hold up your phone. You can record audio on your phone. You can record video on your phone. Well, I can take that back from you, and then I can run that through something and tell you if it's true or not. But how can we get close to real time? Because that's what we're looking for. We're looking to deliver back to those people right then what's true and not.
Describe what Truth Teller looks like. Give me a general idea of how it works.
A user comes to truthteller.washingtonpost.com, and you can select a video, and you press play. And what happens is the video starts to play, and our software takes this video, extracts the audio, turns that audio into the transcript that you'll see, and then that transcript is then being matched in real-time fashion to our database. So you will see in real time what's true and what's false.
But you have a couple of problems. One is it relies on speech to text. It's getting better, but it's still notoriously unreliable. But even if you have excellent speech to text, you still need something for the computer to read. You need facts. And right now, you probably don't have a computer powerful enough to assemble and extrapolate facts from the entire internet. You have to feed them, right?
What we built basically is a database that we're manually at the moment feeding facts into.
And you've limited yourself for now to one subject, right?
We have.
Which is?
Tax debate, tax reform, we wanted to sort of direct it to the conversation that we're expecting to happen in the next couple of months. And we sort of try to test it around the speeches that these politicians will be making around this particular subject.
Also, aren't those facts a little easier to come by since they involve numbers?
I think that's definitely fair to say. I mean, for instance, I'm looking at one of the facts right now that we say is true. Gary Connolly claimed in a speech that Ronald Reagan raised taxes in 1982, 1984, 1985, 1986, and 1987. We said that's true. And then we can actually point to our source that says that, which in this case happens to be PolitiFact, which we cite and we link back to. But yes, it's much more black and white than, say, you know, gun control or something like that.
You're talking about Democratic Congressman Gerald Connally. You know, he did correctly identify the claim that Reagan had raised taxes in those years. But let's look at this other assertion.
The Recovery Act, which I proudly supported, cut taxes for 95% of all Americans, averaging $400 for individuals and $800 for families.
But your truth-telling device misheard a word. The truth-teller transcript says, the Recovery Act, which I probably supported, as opposed to proudly supported, cut taxes but 95% of all Americans averaging $400 for individuals and $800 for families, which almost sounds as if the but is a negation of the claim that the Recovery Act cut taxes for 95% of Americans. And so it labeled the statement as false.
You will see in our About This post in the Truth Teller, I made a note that we may be returning some false positives right now, and we're actually going by hand and looking at those, and we basically have to get better at this translation, as you point out, and then we have to tune our algorithm to do better matching, and then we've got to get more facts in our database. So yes, it is a prototype in the truest sense of the word.
You mentioned Siri at the top. Were you thinking of ever giving Truth Teller a voice?
You know, when I told Stephen, yes, we can do something, it's fun to have big dreams and ideas to work toward. I think that that's going to be really hard to do, but you have to let people talk into it, hold it up, record things, and then you have to be able to offer them speech back. Yes, true, false. You know, we've absolutely.
I want you to do it, Corey.
Okay, I'm on the case.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Corey Hike is the Washington Post's executive producer for digital news, and you can check out the Truth Teller yourself at truthteller.washingtonpost.com.
Up next, some literary examples of fiction masquerading as truth from Truman Capote and Richard Kapuscinski.
This is On the Media. By the way, if you have a minute, check out our blog at onthemedia.org. Several states had their emergency broadcast systems broken into, warning of zombie apocalypse.
Do not attempt to approach or apprehend these bodies as they are considered extremely dangerous.
You'll see some great sound and video and the Canadian reaction at onthemedia.org.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com and 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For nearly 50 years, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood has stood as perhaps the best of the true crime genre. Capote's book chronicles the grisly murder of Mr. and Mrs. Clutter and two of their four children in Holcomb, Kansas. The book is such a cultural touchstone, it's been adapted into an opera, a graphic novel, two punk songs, a TV miniseries, and most notably, three films. Here's Philip Seymour Hoffman as Capote.
Until one morning in mid-November 1959, few Americans, in fact few Kansans, had ever heard of Holcomb. Like the waters of the Arkansas River, like the motorists on the highway, exceptional happenings never stopped there.
Last week, the Wall Street Journal reported on decades-old documents that have recently come to light, which point to significant fabrications in two chapters of Capote's masterwork, including one of its most thrilling moments. Wall Street Journal reporter Kevin Heliker says that in Capote's telling, the Kansas Bureau of Investigation acted immediately after getting a tip from a convict who shared a prison cell with one of the killers.
It begins with an inmate named Floyd Wells coming forth and telling his warden who killed the Clutter family. The warden immediately picks up the phone and calls the KBI. The chief detective is Alvin Dewey. That very day, Capote says, Dewey comes home and shows his wife the mugshots and the rap sheets for these two suspects and indicates that this is it, the case is solved. What the KBI files show is that actually 5 days passed between Floyd Wells coming forth with the names and the KBI showing up at the Hickok farm, which was the last known whereabouts of suspect Richard Hickok. And what's really fascinating, given how much time has passed, is that there is one witness who can explain that 5-day gap. And that is the gentleman who prosecuted the case, Dwayne West, who's 81 years old. His memory of this is very sharp. He was in the sheriff's office that morning, and when it was announced that morning that a prisoner at Kansas State Penitentiary named Richard Hickok and Perry Smith, Alvin Dewey said, "It's not them."
Capote's hero.
Capote's hero.
Can you describe the relationship between Alvin Dewey and Truman Capote?
The letters of Truman Capote on file at the New York Public Library show Truman asking for all manner of information from Alvin Dewey, including the diary of 16-year-old Nancy Clutter, her last entry logged only moments before Smith and Hickok murdered the entire family.
You're saying that Dewey gave Capote access to that diary without her family's
consent? Without her family's consent. According to Detective Harold Nye, Alvin Dewey gave Capote access to the entire KBI file, and that if this had become public, that Dewey would have been fired. And Capote's letters are just rich with gratitude to Dewey. He called him Foxy. Bless you, Foxy, for this. Bless you for that. The original contract between Truman Capote and Columbia Pictures for the movie rights requires that Columbia hire Marie Dewey, Alvin Dewey's wife, as a consultant to the film for $10,000, which was significantly more than the average income of a U.S. family in 1965. And that's really one of any number of "you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back."
Truman Capote's In Cold Blood is regarded in some ways as the text for the new journalism. First of all, how did its inaccuracies hurt the people involved? And second of all, why didn't they come forward?
You know, if you live in Garden City, Kansas, how do you fight back against a book that the entire literary world is embracing and throwing parties for? The clearest example of how Capote's methods affected the people involved is Dwayne West, the man who prosecuted the killers, treated Capote the same as he treated all other journalists, which is he gave nobody any special access. And Capote very much punished Dwayne West. He mischaracterized him in the book as the assistant prosecutor. He essentially gave Dwayne West a demotion and called Dwayne West a 28-year-old who looks 40 and sometimes 50.
But why did it take primary documents to uncover this when anyone could have stepped forward in the past decades and say, this just isn't how it happened?
I think people have tried to. Look at Lance Armstrong. How many people came forth in the last 12 years and offered eyewitness testimony that Lance Armstrong had doped? And
you're not comparing Lance Armstrong to Truman Capote.
Yeah, I think there is a similarity there. You know, there's a myth. I wanted to believe that Lance had cleanly won 7 Tour de France titles. I wanted to believe that Truman Capote had produced the greatest piece of nonfiction ever while hewing to the facts. I mean, even when my story ran, I received emails from people who say that they don't care what the documents show, that it's the greatest piece of nonfiction ever.
What's the really important thing that people should realize about this? Is it about the process? Is it about the story? What should people take away from it?
When you look at how A, Capote was willing to bend facts whenever it suited him, and B, the way that he rewarded those who cooperated with him and punished those who didn't, the biggest question about In Cold Blood will never be known, and that is, how accurately did he portray the relationship between Dick Hickok and Perry Smith, and how accurate is the enormous part of the book that deals only with those two, that is sourced only by those two, and whose truth we can never know because he waited until after those two were executed to produce the book? Now, there's an irony that is central to the book that Capote loved, which is that the killer, the man who actually shot the Clutters, Perry Smith, was deep and sensitive and lovable, and that the other guy, Dick Hickok, was just a petty criminal.
Okay. What's the matter? We're the matter. We're ridiculous. You tap into walls for a safe that isn't there. Tap, tap, tapping like some nutty woodpecker. Oh. And me, crawling around on the floor with my legs on fire. And all to steal a kid's silver dollar.
My question is, did Capote shape those characters to suit this narrative of his that the killer was the good guy and that the other guy was an unredeemable hood?
Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Heliker is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
As a writer of supposed nonfiction who fictionalized his work, Capote is joined by such giants as New Yorker writer Joseph Mitchell and Polish journalist and author Ryszard Kapuściński. When Kapuściński's crimes against nonfiction were discovered a couple of years ago, I spoke to Lawrence Weschler, NYU professor and master of narrative nonfiction himself. I was upset to find out that one of my heroes had cheated. Weschler told me he thought that my rules of journalistic truth and consequences were misguided.
And I would start out by asking you, is anybody ever not making stuff up? When you pick up the newspaper and read about a news conference, let's say, you are relying on a reporter to select the important things and to put them in a particular order. You are assuming that his editor has gone and reshaped those things. That is all fictional activity in the sense that it is composing, it is making up a world. We should at least start with that. Something I often think about is Borges, the great Argentinian writer, who says that there are two universes. There is the universe of material reality, of bodies, of places, and there's the universe of words. And any attempt to shape a representation of one in terms of the other is provisional at best. It is falling apart as we speak. It is something which he calls a fiction.
All right, so stipulated, journalism is by its very nature subjective.
I would stipulate it is more glorious than that. It is narrative. It is storytelling. And there's a kind of story that you seem to prefer from the way you're talking, just the facts, man, blah, blah, blah.
Okay, hold on. We're talking about narrative. Let's speak about Joseph Mitchell, who I must say was one of my great heroes and wrote about these just absolutely indelible characters. And lo and behold, come to discover sometime in the 90s, at least in my case, that these remarkable characters weren't individuals. They were...
Not all of them were. There were a few composites. And in particular, it was one book in particular, Old Mr. Flood, which was quite consciously a more fictional exercise. But most of the stories he told were not composites. I mean, Joe Gould, I would argue the single greatest piece of American narrative nonfiction of the 20th century. Joe Gould was by no means a composite. Having said that, there's all sorts of fictional devices that Mitchell uses to extraordinary effect, and I would argue in the service of the truth of the story.
So what's the difference between truth with a lowercase t, which I think would rule out fabrication, and truth with a capital T that permits it?
Well, let's take the example of Joe Gould's Secret. When you read that text, there are these 20-page conversations that are just absolutely grueling and amazing and marvelous at the same time. I would argue that the conversation did not take place exactly like that. And he tells you this, that he had dozens and dozens and dozens of conversations with Joe Gould over a period of months, and that he is then giving you a sense of what it was like to talk to Joe Gould. Whether or not Joe Gould said those particular things at that particular conversation, of course he didn't.
So then you're saying that when you learned that Ryszard Kapuściński's portrait of Emperor Haile Selassie were just filled with inventions and fabrications and historical inaccuracies, that you didn't feel betrayed?
No, first of all, I don't buy any of those characterizations at all, and you're wrong about all of them. This whole story is being told in a different register. During the daytime, he was a press agency reporter for the Polish press agency. He would file typical journalistic stories in the same way that, for example, Oliver Sacks, in his dailiness, does clinical notes of that day's meetings with different patients. Years later, they return to the story in a different register, what I call rhapsodic nonfiction. They sing it in a different mode. I am back here in Poland. I am telling you a story about what it was like there. One of the things that is conspicuous when you read The Emperor is he has all these different people telling stories, and they all have exactly the same voice. This is not because he's incompetent. This is because he's conspicuously giving you a kind of Aladdin and the 40 Nights kind of quality to what he's doing. In the case of Kapuscinski, what he was doing in that book, it is an absolutely remarkable piece of literature. He was writing in Poland in 1978, having an incredible game going on with the censor. This was the late days, just before Solidarity, of an incredibly corrupt regime. And because he was writing about the downfall of an incredibly corrupt capitalist-oriented regime, Haile Selassie, he could tell that story, and everybody in Poland knew that he was really talking about the communists, and everybody knew that the censors couldn't block him because he was telling the official version of what had happened.
Yeah, Haile Selassie was his beard, and the emperor was a sort of animal farm.
It operates as reportage of a certain sort, but also as a specific allegory of what was going on in Poland. It operates as general allegory of any kind of system that you've ever lived in. You've, I'm sure, worked under an emperor in your time. And it, for that matter, just operates in the realm of Kafka and Marquez.
So are there no victims, however, among those who believe they were getting the inside dope on Haile Selassie and the people whose stories were being told?
I think, first of all, an awful lot of what you're reading in The Emperor is what you would call inside dope. There are flights, and I think they advertise themselves as flights. And what is expected as a reader of literature, of which this is, by the way, and by the way, Joseph Mitchell is literature also, in addition to being reportage of a certain sort, one is expected to be an adult reader. It was a different sort of activity than daily journalism and needs to be read that way.
You know, I know you're going to dismiss me as a silly reactionary, but to me, the quotation mark is an affidavit from the author certifying verbatim. If I'm putting it between the quotation marks, that means this is what he or she said in these words, perhaps cleaned up to reflect the difference between spoken language and written language, but certainly not shading meaning any which way. Mm-hmm. Is that just a preposterously naive way to approach quotation marks?
It's not preposterously naive, but here I'm going to talk for myself. I have never had a quote of mine challenged, something I've put in quotation marks. I generally don't use tape recorders. I basically tried to give both the gist of what was said and the voice in which it was said. I don't think I've ever quoted anybody verbatim. I quote what people remember having said. I am scrupulously fair. Something which I do that a lot of people don't do is I show the quotes to people before I publish them. In my first book, my profile, Robert Irwin, Seeing is Forgetting the Name of the Thing One Sees, that was the result of 3 years of conversations. I took those conversations and I would go home and write notes. And when I then put the story together, I created a series of scenes, gave you a sense of what it was like to hang out with Robert Irwin. You want me to give you a sense of what it's like to walk down the street with David Hockney, what it's like to be at the War Crimes Tribunal and so forth. You want the quotes to be quotes that the person who was being quoted would stand behind as something that they said. Verbatim is not the issue. You do this all the time. You know you do this. You've had shows about how you do this. You take quotes, you take something from here, and you put it next to something from there and so forth, because you then get a closer representation of what was actually said. The person spoke for 5 minutes. You find the 30 seconds out of the 5 minutes that add up to a single thing. And no one accuses you, if you do a good job of it, if you're honest, if you're fair and so forth, no one accuses you of breaking any rules.
What you say is true, and just like you, we have never in 10 years had a complaint about misrepresenting anybody's idea.
You've killed my tooth fairy. You mean people don't say the things they say on your show in the way they say them?
Yeah, all right, point taken.
By the way, I should tell you a funny story. I was once on a panel with Ian Fraser. Somebody, the audience raised their hand and asked which novels we read. And I gave the novels that I read, and then we turned to him, and he said, I don't read novels. And I said, what do you mean you don't read novels? He said, well, you know, when you read a novel, it begins, Johnny was walking down the street. And all I can think of is, no, he wasn't.
And now that is exactly how I have to approach all journalism, because if your standards apply, I can't get past the inverted pyramid.
Let's be clear on my standards. At the top of my standards are fairness, accuracy, creating something that is true to life. All that are very high in my standards. I'm just claiming that it is impossible to go out there as if you're going to laminate the world, as if you're going to take a Xerox machine and put it up to the face of reality and deliver it to your readers. That's ridiculous. Everything is selection, is shading, is trying to figure out what ordering things should go in and so forth, is imputing significance to a whole series of granular facts and so forth. That happens all the time. And the people who I cherish are people who can tell me stories that illuminate the world for me in an accurate way. And nothing I have described detracts from that.
Ren, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lawrence Weschler is the director of the New York Institute for the Humanities. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, and the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Frankel.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, but we want to give a special, special thanks to the great Jamie York for filling in while she was on maternity leave for 6 months. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.